1590 AM Denmark, W250 CD Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News, the race for the White House. I'm Chuck Sievertson. ABC's Andy Field monitoring the CNN presidential debate.
Each candidate making it clear they think the other is a criminal. President Biden pointing out former President Trump is an actual convicted felon. Mr. Trump saying Mr. Biden should be one. At one point, President Biden reminding the audience of Mr. Trump's court losses, bringing up something never heard in any presidential debate, that Mr. Trump slept with a porn star and was found liable for molesting a woman. Both candidates describing what appear to be an alternative universe view of nearly every major voter concern.
Galen Truk, their partners at the political analysis site 538.
On average, going back to 1976, the first debate has changed the polls by about 2.5 percentage points. And so actually, we should expect this debate to move some voters.
This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Another attempt to recall State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss comes up short. The Wisconsin Elections Commission ruled Thursday the recall petitioners failed to turn in enough valid signatures. Three Republican commissioners and one Democrat voted that hundreds of signatures were gathered after the deadline. Outreach specialists are trying to recruit the next generation of Hmong farmers in Wisconsin. Many Hmong farmers are getting close to retirement age and their grown children have different ideas about farming.
Older Hmong farmers, farming is therapeutic for them. They're making a little bit of money, but also farming and gardening makes them happy. The difference is that these younger farmers, they want farming to be financially sustainable.
Ye'imo Yang is with the Groundswell Conservancy. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
1, 2, 3.
What you doing?
4, 5, 6. Counting the first place awards from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association.
WISS in Oshkosh for the best promo. WAUK in Waukesha, best Maggie Dawn Show web story. WMDX in Madison, best web story about the Max Inc. radio show. And WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids for best show, interview, and promo.
Informed, entertained, connected.
And winning.
Your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Take solace in knowing, look, over the next several weeks, we're going to be seeing a lot of information coming out about tax time. You know, the IRS is going to, there's some stuff coming up. But hey, congratulations, American workers. Your sacrifice, we have the largest 1%. Pretty much ever, because now the top 1% of earners in this country have now more wealth than the entire middle class. Congratulations. You did it. Lower diminished, you know, standard of living, more tax breaks. This is good, right? This is good because, you know, the smart people, the 1%, they know what to do with the money, right? They're going to put it to work. And it's going to trickle down. And it may trickle on you. Congratulations. Now, I do find it interesting, according to our friends at Americans for Tax Fairness, that our millionaires and our wealth class are now paying about half the tax rate they did pre-1980. Also, corporations, you may remember, they provided about a third of our revenue at one point. Now that share of our revenue down to 10%. So the argument is the wealthy getting wealthier, the rich getting richer, and the working people poorer. Corporate America raking in massive profits. In fact, I saw this meme over on the Facebooks, And it said, you know, orange juice was, you know, like $2 a thing. And now it's like, you know, $4 a thing. It's like a 48% jump. And they went through a whole bunch of grocery items and they did this. And you're supposed to be angry that inflation has happened. And the way the comments went, it's all Joe Biden's fault. Because he's in charge of evidently the commodities market. Evidently there's some kind of a switch that says, you know, hyperinflation. I wish someone would have done that chart of the companies that make those products and what their profit margins were, how much they paid out in CEO bonuses, how much they gave to shareholders, how much they spent on stock buybacks. Because again, I think you'll find it very interesting that, you know, while inflation was rising, these companies were bragging about the fact that, hey, we're doing great. You throw in the greedflation, you throw in the shrinkflation, you know, we're selling less, we're making more money. It's great. And, you know, I'm stuck in these positions of understand our right-wing controlled corporate media regurgitates the same talking points over and over again. The repetition is the same. In fact, you know, I started hearing the R word just today, that, you know, we're heading for a recession, right? So that's going to rear its ugly head again, because, you know, we need that evidently. We need to keep pushing, because, you know, maybe someday they're going to be right. Like street corner preachers who claim tomorrow is going to be the end of the world. At some point, if you preach long enough and if you believe long enough that maybe possibly tomorrow will be the end of the world. And the same thing is with the recession. At some point, we know another recession will come. It's not shocking, not surprising. But to keep working towards it, to keep hoping for it, I don't know. It's one of those things where I go, I think you're trying to work against the best interest of the country. And I give Biden credit for not getting involved in the noise. I've said before, he wasn't my first choice, but he was the right choice for the moment. His calm and not getting involved in all of these scraps is refreshing. It's what we need. He's just doing the job. And it's paying off because, you know, the Center for American Progress points out that a household wealth for people under 40 is up 49% from before the pandemic. And understand, you know, these younger households, I haven't seen wage growth like this. Well, I guess since the Federal Reserve started tracking this stuff back in 1989, things are going in the right direction. We're seeing movement. We're seeing more organizing happening, so people are winning better contracts. But for the vast majority of people that aren't in unions, and I wish we had 35% union density in the private sector. Just getting people to come to work now, because people internalize that, you know, frontline hero thing, that essential thing. They're now going, you know, it's not worth it. It's not worth it for me to trade the hours of my life for the pittance that you were offering, and we demand better. And this is a good thing. And we do need a moment where we go, you know, the CEOs are making big money, really, really big money. The shareholders are making really, really big money. Shouldn't workers be making reasonable money so that they can put food on the table, a roof over their head, and have the security of health care and retirement? I don't know that it's too much to ask, but, you know, we are in a weird kind of space. And I got to tell you, it's one of these things that I'm hoping that we start asking the right questions instead of just learning through osmosis and absorbing all of these right-wing talking points that they keep shoveling out at us. You know, the economy's bad. It's all Joe Biden's fault. That's the easy message. The right message is, well, corporate America is gouging you. They're getting fat and happy, which, again, you look back and you go, how did the 1%? How did 1% of the people have more wealth than the middle class? Look, I understand it. If you're talking about, you know, the bottom of the economic scale, the poverty end of things, where people don't have anything, but the middle class, that's supposed to be Well, that's supposed to be where the wealth is. That's supposed to be where the hope is. That's supposed to be where all this the good stuff is, right? Isn't it? I'm not sure, but we will see. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something of mine, want to hear it. If you miss any of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Going to take a quick break when we come back. Scott Paul's going to be here from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Some Buy American stuff, some Made in America stuff, some stuff that we need. Stick around. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So our tweet of the day comes from Lena Khan at the Federal Trade Commission, and this is the reason you have people like Lena Khan in this position. Evidently, William Sonoma made in America products, or so they claimed. Only we find out that, well, they were actually made in China. And as Lena Khan points out, they are a repeat violator, the folks at Williams-Sonoma. And because of this, they're going to pay what is a record penalty of $3.17 million in civil fines for violating the Federal Trade Commission's Made in the USA order. And look, there could be more. There should be more enforcement of this. And I got to tell you, I'm thrilled to see finally doing something. And here to share some thoughts on, well, is this a step in the right direction? And should we be doing more? I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Great to be with you.
So big deal here, I think. A step in the right direction. Finally, maybe we're going to start enforcing this Made in America thing.
Yeah, for people who care about like the Made in America label or seeing more things made here, totally. This is a huge deal. For years, we've had a Federal Trade Commission that had policies that if any sort of like labeling violation, and believe me, there's lots of incentives to try to label something made in America, even if it's made in China, right? Because you get that, you can charge a premium for it. Customers might be more interested. They might associate with higher quality or whatever. So there's tons of reasons to do it. But up until just a few years ago, all the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, was ever doing was a slap on the wrist, like a strongly worded letter to the company saying bad boys and girls, don't do this again. And that was really it. And so there really wasn't a whole lot of incentive for companies to change. But about 4 years ago, the FTC started to impose fines for this, which is something we had argued through the regulatory process for a long time they should be doing. And yeah, so this is the biggest fine ever because Williams-Sonoma and Pottery Barn, which is one of its subsidiaries, this is the second time they've been busted for falsely labeling things as made in America when in fact they're made in China or somewhere else.
No, you know, I'm a big Made in America fan for one reason, that the jobs that those create, that the people making that stuff, you know, those are my friends and neighbors, me as well. You know, as a truck driver, we move goods around. So the idea of having things made here, employees who have jobs here, that reverberation effect in communities, that's important to me. And I think it's important to a lot of people. And we should have that choice and the right information. And this is where Lena Khan in her next tweet is spot on. She goes, look, made in the U.S. fraud deceives customers and punishes honest businesses. I 100% agree with that.
That is totally right, because if you think about this, you know, a firm who's making a commitment to make products in the United States, there's lots of advantages because we spend more money than any other consumer market in the world. So there's definitely lots of advantages to be in the United States. But, you know, there are minimum wage laws. They aren't high enough in some places, but they're still a lot higher than they are in a lot of the rest of the world, right? Particularly the developing world. There are environmental standards, and some people want to see those raised, but still the existing environmental standards are probably far more strenuous than you're going to face anywhere in a country like China.
Yep.
And so right there, you know, you have a business owner that said, you know what, I'm going to bear more costs, but I'm committed to making this product in the United States for whatever reason, right? It could be a lot of different reasons. And then you have consumers on the other side who are committed to buying that product, perhaps at a slightly higher cost, because they're like, there are benefits, as you said, Rick, to my neighbors, to my community. There's it's more sustainable. There's less shipping involved with this, or it's patriotic. I mean, whatever the reason it is, there is a tangible value to all of that. So anytime a company is fraudulently claiming that it's making something in the United States, it is taking advantage of the companies and it's defrauding those who are actually doing the right things, as well as defrauding consumers who think that they're buying a product that was perhaps made by their friends and neighbors, when in fact it wasn't. It was made in China under who knows what different kinds of conditions. And so the fact that the FTC is now fining companies like Williams-Sonoma will increase the integrity and the value of that Made in America label and make consumers know that they can trust it as well.
Yeah, well, $3.17 million is a lot of money. Is it the punishment fitting the crime? Honestly and truthfully, I don't think so, but again, a step in the right direction. But the reason I bring this up is, you know, we've been talking about Made in America for a very long time. And I remember years ago, Walmart was doing that. You know, we believe in Made in America while they're pushing manufacturers overseas. And it sadly for a lot of people has given us this bad taste in our mouth, because Made in America is more than just sewing a label on something. It's about actually producing something. So in looking at this, and this is where I wanted your expertise, this to me is a good sign that someone's paying attention to, is it really made in America? I mean, really? Or is this one of those things that someone just, well, we got the finished product, somebody sewed a label on it, and now we're going to push it off?
That's right. That's right. And so the FTC has, the Federal Trade Commission has a very clear definition of what can be labeled made in America. Okay. And it is basically all or substantially all of that product has to be sourced from the United States and the final assembly has to occur here. Otherwise, you have to do something that's called a qualified label. Like it's manufactured in the United States with imported and domestic components, okay? That's what you have to say. And then you also have to be careful if you're a company about, like, do you have patriotic imagery that's associated with it that would lead anybody to believe that it might be made in America if they're not paying close attention? And so, and you'll find, and I just know this because obviously we do this, this is part of our line of work, that there's lots, you know, there's lots of companies that like skirt the line right on there to try to, you know, I don't want to say that they're preying on consumers, but that's certainly the result of what is happening here. And so for the FTC to put scrutiny on this is going to be helpful. And look, we've had cases where people flat out knew that the products were coming from China companies and they slapped the Made in America label on it because they're like, you know what, this is going to sell me more product. And so this is going to put a stop to that. And for all of the gnashing about the Federal Trade Commission and what it is doing or isn't doing, I mean, this is one of the very important services it provides to consumers, because this is about consumer protection. And for some people, you know, it's not only the types of ingredients that are in something that matter, but it's also the country of origin. And, you know, some people buy, you know, invoke their values when they're buying something, and they may not want to purchase something from China because of, you know, an ongoing genocide against the Uyghurs or suppression of Tibetans or the system of government they have, or the oppression of labor or the carbon emissions or whatever. And so having clarity and having a full right to know is very important. And we're just also getting into a new frontier here, because so many people buy stuff online, right? So many people buy stuff online. And the FTC is now just able to, because of a regulatory process, enforce digital labeling. Now, there's still no requirement that there has to be country of origin labeling online. Okay, that's Senator Baldwin and Senator J.D. Vance have legislation to do that. There's still no requirement, but if you are making that claim, the FTC also has the right to police that now, and they didn't before. And so we're starting to see progress, and thank God it's been so overdue, because there's been so much abuse of this over the decades.
No, and for someone like me, who that's important, I don't want someone to be able to play on my assumptions that the label says made in the U.S. Well, really isn't. And I look at my tennis shoes. I buy New Balance tennis shoes, and they label it, made in the U.S. with foreign parts.
That's right.
So I know all the stuff coming in, you know, was sewn somewhere else, and they did some assembly here, but I can't find tennis shoes anywhere else that are made in the U.S., and that's sad part.
You're right. Yeah. Well, and you're right. And so for a company like New Balance, they are able to set themselves apart, because unlike almost all of these other mass market shoe manufacturers, whether it's Nike or Adidas or you name it, who have really no production here in the United States, at least New Balance has like four factories here where they are putting together some tennis shoes. And yes, some have some imported content that's coming in, but that's a heck of a lot better than their competitors are doing. And so they're able to offer that qualified claim. And I'm just gonna say, Rick, even we who do this for a living, you know, we bought a television set for our office here because it said it was made in America and had a big flipping flag on it and had a worker, you know, who was there. And it was made by a company called Element Electronics. And it turns out that literally the whole thing was basically made in China, and all they did was pack it here. And so we filed a case with the FTC, and also a reporter went inside their factory and was like, basically, this is not, they ain't making a TV here, really, right? And so we were able to bust them. But it's just like, it just goes to show that, you know, we do this for policy work. And we bought something because we believed that it was manufactured in the United States. And so we did. I mean, we were able to file a case at the FTC, and we got some recourse on this company a little bit. They had to change the way they were marketing it. But it's just like, come on. You know, so I'm glad that they are stepping up enforcement, because it is long, long, long overdue. And it's going to be a good thing ultimately for brands that do want to manufacture in the United States.
Yeah, no, and look, not abusing my assumption. Like you said, you saw the flag on it, you saw the American worker, it said made in the U.S. You shouldn't have to go, you know, on a research tour to find out where this thing was made. I mean, you should be able to believe what the box says. It's that simple. And look, I look at this administration, and I believe that they want to rebuild manufacturing. They believe in made in America, which is why I come to this question that I've got. Because evidently what I'm seeing is it's been reported that the EPA is looking at giving some waivers on this Clean Ports program.
Yeah.
And look, we're going to spend about $3 billion on this Clean Ports program. And there's talk of waivers from the Buy American thing. Am I getting this right?
Yeah. And so this is hopefully we can put a stop to this. But this is still an active concern. And yeah, there's a lot of money that's being devoted to try to decarbonize port facilities in the United States. And the Environmental Protection Agency apparently didn't get the memo from the White House that said we're doing Buy America. And they want to waive these requirements and try to get the money out the door. And look, we've acknowledged, because I think we've talked about this, that, you know, we're trying to rebuild like shipbuilding and port capacity, because candidly, it's fallen to low levels. But we ought to do that in concert with, and it just seems kind of like counterproductive to, on the one hand, have this trade case where you're trying to restore shipbuilding and port capacity in the United States, and then on the other hand, you're giving money basically to, potentially to Chinese companies to try to do things that will help to decarbonize ports in the United States. And so we're like, you know, shaking our head, shrugging our shoulders, and like, what's going on here? And we're, you know, lawmakers, I think, are noticing this. So hopefully we can put a stop to this. But here's the way of saying, Rick, old habits die hard. And so when an agency is used to doing something a certain way, you know, it doesn't like change. And it's like, we don't know how to handle this. And so in this case, it's way more important, I think, to get it right and to develop that capacity to manufacture that equipment in the United States than to short circuit it and say, look, we want to get this money out of the door. We're just going to waive the requirement and we'll bring the stuff in from China. I don't think that's going to, in the long term, serve the interest of our taxpayers, our workers, or efforts to make sure that we're reshoring more manufacturing jobs in the United States.
I'm right there with you. I got to get your final thoughts on your movie event, relightingtheflamefilm.com, if you want to check out the movie. And look, you know, as I watched it, you know, my heart, you know, smiled a little bit. Because you brought my hometown of Cleveland, something positive happening to my hometown. Flame I saw for years, it was the flame of prosperity. It was the flame of knowing that we were producing. And the weird thing is, I was just talking about this to my daughter the other day, because she had asked me, you know, questions. She came home from school, did an interview about, hey, you grew up during the Cold War. What was it like? And I said, look, you know, I grew up in an industrial hub. We knew if there was ever, you know, a mutual assured destruction, we were first on the list because of this manufacturing prowess that we were so proud of. So when that flame went out, that kind of hit. But in the movie, you show it being lit back up and things moving in the right direction and lives getting better. The one woman said that she moved out of her parents' basement and bought her own home. That's good stuff, man.
Yeah. It's not only good stuff, it's great stuff. I mean, I think that's the thing about it, is there's so many narratives, if you think about it, about factory closings. And look, that's still going on. And I don't want to minimize it at all. And then just if you see a movie of manufacturing, it's like an abandoned warehouse and there's like some horrific thing that's about to happen, right? Always, always that's the case. And so here's a case where people are going back into this factory. It's a new generation. And yeah, instead of being saddled with debt like their colleagues who went to a four-year college degree and are working in something where they don't need the degree actually, but they have all the student debt, these younger people are making $80,000. They're buying their own houses. They're contributing back to their community. They feel like they have a family at work. And part of that is because they have a union. They have the Steelworkers Union. Part of that is because they have companies that believe in domestic production and want to make things again. And part of it is because we have the policies that are going to, you know, reinvest, you know, more than $1 trillion in our own economy. We have tariffs on unfairly traded steel, finally. And so there's actually a framework where you can see these jobs growing into the future. And it is a good news story. And so it's Cleveland. And then we just showed it in Northwest Indiana, which is the largest steelmaking region in the country. And it's the same reaction there, Rick, because for years it had been nothing but closures, and layoffs. And now they're hiring, right? They're hiring at these mills. And so it's a story worth telling, we think.
No, look, I had friends who worked in that mill. I had family members who worked at LTV. You had Republic, you had all the steel mills down there. And sadly, most of them are gone by the wayside. But this one, the flame back up. So I hope folks will take a look at it. Relightingtheflamefilm.com. We'll get links out on social media. But lastly, and I want to go back to what we were talking about, made in the U.S. You know, this idea that I'm willing to pay a little bit more for products. You know, in the film, you've got a couple, you know, basically buying a gas grill. And the husband's looking at the gas grill and the wife's going, look, you know, it yeah. might be cheaper, but is it better for us?
That's
what
right.
is the cost of cheaper? Yeah. And I thought that was an important frame.
Yeah, I loved when she said that. And it was a very poignant point, is that it's not always, there's more into it than the actual price. There's a human being behind it, or, you know, obviously more than one human being, but that ought to be part of what people are considering. And look, no one is 100% pure. You don't have to be, but just be a little better.
That's right.
Right? Just be a little better.
No, I'm not perfect, but I try.
Yeah.
I try to, where it's possible, I make sure that I try. And good on you guys. Hope folks will take a look at the film, relightingtheflamefilm.com. We'll get links out on social media. Scott, as always, appreciate the time.
Of course, Rick, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website if you want to check out that work. But hey, relightingtheflamefilm.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can check it out. Highly, highly recommended. Quick break. Right back.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly cloudy skies here in the overnight and a light south to southeast wind. And by daybreak, temperatures in the mid and upper 50s. Showers and thunderstorms possible for your Friday. Mostly cloudy skies. Highs in the middle 70s, currently 62 degrees.
100 days, 144,000 minutes. The countdown to the November presidential election is on, and Maggie Dawn is counting too as she continues her special segment, Biden's Top 100.
Having heard from each and every one of you, I should start talking about what President Biden is proposing us for his second term.
Biden's Top 100 continues. You're invited to be part of it too. Call or text the Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays starting at 2, across the Civic Media Radio Network and the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week we talked about, you know, really more positive changes coming out of the Biden administration for working people. The end of non-competes, you know, peanut butter and jelly no longer proprietary, a new final rule on silica dust exposure, millions more workers getting access to overtime by raising the exempt threshold. There's a lot of stuff that are, honestly, the folks that he has put into place doing the job. And look, as I've said a number of times, Joe Biden is the most pro-union, pro-worker president of at least my lifetime. So it's no surprise that labor is showing their approval. You may remember back at the beginning of this month, the Utility Workers Union of America, UWUA, they joined the long list of labor organizations across the country who threw their support and endorsement of their more than 50,000 members behind the president. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, why UWUA chose Joe Biden to support, I've asked Jim Slevin to come talk with us. Jim is the president of the Utility Workers Union of America, UWUA.net, their website. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you for including us in the conversation.
So why? Well, you know, what is it that you think is got Biden's endorsement? Why are we going this direction?
You know, you said it there. You know, Joe Biden is pro-labor. He's pro-working class people. He really is connecting with the workers that are out there and the utility workers today. And we thought it was the right time. We brought our executive board together, and our executive board said, hey, listen, let's get behind this guy. He's the right guy. He's the perfect person for the movement, and not just for the president's position, but really for working class people. He's gotten the message, and he's done it right. It's not just Joe. It's also his administration. He's put the right people in, like you said, at the right time, and people that aren't just, you know, not just at the table, but they're listening. And they're acting. So we definitely, we thought it was the right point for the utility workers to make a statement. And we got together, and it wasn't unanimous, our endorsement, but it was definitely a great conversation with the executive board.
No, and look, I understand that, you know, we're in this really polarized moment, and I tell my friends, you know, we've got to get away from the red hat, blue hat fight and get into the hard hat conversation about how we're going to rebuild this country and whose policies and vision and administrations are going to help in this. And, you know, I've said before, I understand why labor is moving towards Biden, because we had 4 years of Donald Trump telling us he was going to rebuild the country, telling us he was going to reshore manufacturing. And then all we got were photo ops and gimmicks. You know, Biden may not be out there doing the photo ops, but he's actually doing the work. So it's not surprising to me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of my executive board members put it perfectly when we took the vote, and he had said to us, I don't believe in everything that Joe Biden is doing. I don't agree with everything he's doing, but he is the right candidate for us, and he is the right candidate for labor, and he is definitely a pro-union president. You know, you've heard presidents over decades talk about unions, but nobody stood there. Yep. And when Joe Biden stood on his picket line, that's a huge statement, and really not just says the word union, lives the word union.
You know, the joke I've been telling is, you know, since that happened, I said, it looks like, you know, Biden found Obama's comfortable shoes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Obama, you know, I shook his hand twice and he told me twice, we're going to get something better than the Employee Free Choice Act. And they didn't even really try, in my view. But yeah. This guy, you know, found those shoes, got out on a picket line. And to me, that's a big thing. And like you said, I don't agree with everything, but here's the reality. I don't agree with everything that I say. So yeah. I'm never going to agree with everything a politician is going to want or do. But when it comes down to how I'm going to put food on my table, keep a roof over my kids' head, give them opportunity in the future, this seems pretty clear.
Yeah. You know, it's not an easy choice for an organization to make an endorsement, but it's definitely something that we stand behind. Understand the utility workers stand in the shoes of a lot of different kind of utilities today, from water, nuclear, gas, coal, you know, a lot of things in generation. And we really we have difficult times thinking about, well, what's the administration doing for members? Not just one sector, but all sectors. And, you know, it's not easy. Do we agree with some of the stuff that we see going on? We see coal plants being shut down. We see gas being banned in certain areas. We do. But we also see a president that's also taken into consideration to making sure that as we're moving into newer facets of our utility world, that we're really looking at making sure and creating jobs and making sure that they're good paying jobs and they're union jobs. And really, you know, I mean, I can't ask for more. I mean, I really can't ask for more. And I want to make sure that, you know, when we do have a conversation with the administration, it's not come in like what you said, a photo op. It's not coming in and just saying, okay, I hear you, and then walking out of the room and doing something else. It's hearing you, taking what the workers are saying, not me, taking what my workers are saying, and then really taking it and carrying it through, making sure.
Yeah, making sure that they actually, you know, they actually do what we need them to do. You know, I'm right there with you. The reality in this, and I come back to this moment, it's, and you know, Jim, it's amazing to me that this administration has put people into positions that can help your members to succeed, can help move us forward and in a direction that will most certainly give people opportunities for the future. And what's interesting to me, and I come back to this, is you look at the people that he's put into those positions. I look at, you know, Jennifer Brusio at the NLRB. I look at Julie Hsu at the Department of Labor. You know, I look at Lena Khan at the Federal Trade Commission. These are all people who have worker-centric mindsets, that they're doing what they can do to make lives better. And you know, as I said, you know, we saw some of this stuff play out. So, Jim, when you look at the people that he's put into positions, when you're talking to your members, do they get that this just isn't about Joe Biden and Donald Trump? It's about the people that he put into those positions and that the people that Donald Trump put into those same positions and how those different administrations affect their lives.
Yeah, no, the membership do. I mean, you know, we have a connection with the administration, and it's not, like I said, just Joe Biden. We get calls periodically from secretaries. Secretary Granwall, I talk to all the time on it. What's going on in utility workers? When I meet with Julie Hsu, she's the same. It's a personal relationship. And it's not a relationship that's just, okay, she sits over here and we sit over here. It's a connection and throughout labor. And he pushes it down to his administration to make sure that they connect with us, to make sure that they're doing the same as what he wants from them and they're hearing us. So my membership sees it. Like I said,
he's an old school politician. Look, I mean, you know, he remembers the generation, like my grandparents' generation, who, you know, came back from World War II, fought fascism overseas, and then came home and fought to build the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And they did that with their unions. They did that through collective bargaining, through collective action. And I believe he knows that, remembers it, and sees that as the way forward, the way we undo the last 30 years, 40 years of neoliberal idiocy. And to give workers a fair shot to where that thing that we grew up believing in, if you work hard, play by the rules, that you actually do get ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. My parents came here to this country. Both my parents were immigrants and they wanted to make a better life. And they saw the union was actually the way to get that better life. They saw the recognition that collective bargaining at a table, making sure the voice at the workplace, making sure that they're able to go home and provide for their family was it. And he gets that. He gets it. When he talks about like union, he also makes sure that it's not just him saying it. It's his whole administration saying it. And my membership sees that every day. They see what's going on. They see the actions that are done in the field. They're making sure that they're connecting with it. So,
let's move this forward then, because look, you know, this is multi-generational. Your current members see things one way. Your future members, hopefully, we're talking to and you know, parents are pushing in this direction because union job, better life is something that I believe in. You know, in looking at this administration pushing this kind of this mentality, do you think we're creating a generation, you know, like my grandparents' generation, who go into the workplace, believe organizing and fighting for better wages, hours, conditions is the way forward?
Yeah, no, we're seeing a change. We're seeing a shift. And, you know, it used to be when I entered the workplace, it was, okay, young guy, just sit there, listen, and take the lead from the senior people. We're seeing younger workers today voicing up. I mean, in the labor movement, just as utility workers. I mean, look at Starbucks. Workers that are saying, hey, you know what? I want to join a union. I want a voice. We're seeing younger workers and utility workers saying, I want to join a union. We broke barriers just recently and organized in Georgia. We were never in that state before. So we're seeing workers, and I'm connecting with them every day and making sure that they're saying, hey, you know, we're the new face, we're the utility workers, but we're the new face of the utility workers, and hear us because we have something to say. So we're connecting with that today.
No, and that's good. And you know, and I look at the investments coming out of this administration, giving opportunities to rewire America to, you know, you said a moment ago, we may be moving away from gas and coal, but we're moving towards renewables, solar and wind and geothermal and all of this stuff. A lot of that's got wires that need to be strung and the things that need to be done and a country that needs to be rewired. So there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of work for your members and for future members to grow your union.
Yeah. When, you know, during the 90s, when deregulation came in, I'm going to say that we stood on the sidelines. We weren't in the conversation. Today, as we're going through a cleaner energy, we're there. We're in that conversation. And we're making sure that we're taking care of workers, generations that are coming in, but also generations that may be leaving. So we're at that point of really making sure we're in that conversation, making sure that we're at the table and we're at the direction. We need to make sure we take care of the workers that are going to be our future workers. We need to take care of the workers who have generation. Senator Whitehouse really articulated how utility workers, he called them veterans of energy. And no disrespect to our men and women who have served in our armed services, but they're men and women in the utility workers that have served communities, financially made communities grow. And we need to take care of them just like we need to take care of our veterans. So we need to make sure that we're taking care of those who are leaving our industry and taking care of the community, too.
Absolutely. No, it's something we need. And I don't know that we have enough. I mean, every time we have a crisis, there's a call for people like your members to come out and bail us out, which is why I think the future, and hopefully we're investing more in apprenticeship programs, we're bringing more people in, because the need is going to be so much greater in the coming years. And I know you guys are building, what, the first solar and wind apprenticeship program in Michigan, right?
Yeah, we have a WindTech program up in Michigan. We have WindTechs that are on land. We're looking to get into the WindTech area that are offshore. But yeah, we're all on board. We want to make sure that we're looking at the future. And quite honestly, those workers could come from a lot of our plants that are shutting down, but also are going to be our young men and women that are in high schools today. Because the future, we need to really get to them right now and really have that conversation. Show them what the work is. Show them what the skill sets are, and then show them what the salaries, and that they can make a living in this industry too.
And not just a living, but a good living.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, we're pretty proud of our collective bargaining agreements we have on the table, and making sure that they can provide for their families and really start their future.
You know, when we talk about the younger generation, I've got, you know, an 18-year-old son just graduating from high school, and we're looking at what's next for him. And one of the avenues that we're pursuing is an apprenticeship program, because, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Mike Rowe, but I agree with him when he says that, you know, my son's generation is going to be the tool belt generation. They're the ones who are going to have to rebuild this country, especially with the investment that's come out of this administration, and hopefully more that comes in the future. But it's these jobs that are maybe going to be the ones of the future. And maybe you can help me, maybe the ones not wiped out by AI and robotics and the technologies of the future, that these are actually jobs that are going to be around for a while.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, AI and robotics are coming in, but we definitely see that there's a skill set for hands, and nobody can replace the hand in the minds of workers. You know, I was at a retirement party not that long ago, the boss had said to the workers that were in the place, he says, I have two workers that are leaving, but I have a robot that's taken the place. And he says, I can't replace the knowledge that's in those heads, because they've learned over the years. So there's definitely technology that's coming into the industry, but it really doesn't. You could talk to a computer, but the computer won't talk back. You know, you can relate sometimes in workplaces that, yeah, technology's there, but reality is you still need human factors in a lot of these workplaces. And we don't look at it and say, hey, listen, let's just push back at it. We want to see and make sure that we're in a collective bargaining table. Where is this technology, and what play does it play into it? You know, making sure that when we have linemen that are on the poles, those switches are really human people making the moves on those switches to make sure that safety is there, not relying on a computer. Yeah. So we're making sure we're at the forefront of that.
And this administration, I know, is an ally in this. But, you know, one of the things that I give this administration credit for, as we're moving to the new generation of technologies, as we're moving to renewables, there seems to be this want, this policy need for a just transition, so that when new technology does come on the line, it's not the working people getting taking it on the chin, that they're actually going to benefit from the jobs of the future as we're losing the ones of the past. And that's a big deal, considering you look at every transition, you know, going back, you know, 100 years, workers always took it on the chin. There's an opportunity for this time to be different.
You know, we have to get it right. I mean, you know, when you use the word just transition, we really cringe at that, because we've gotten it wrong over decades. And we want to make sure that when we do have this conversation, it's a true transition. And a true transition is that making sure that, and especially in some of the facets of like coal and gas and areas that we're in, making sure that it's workers, it's community, and making sure that it's actually the energy too, is making sure that they all go together, not one that they all move in the same movement. So when we like make sure a transition is let's be honest with ourselves. Make sure it's a true transition, not a just transition.
All right, so. I'm right there with you. Jim Slevin, I appreciate the time. President of the Utility Workers Union of America, UWU.net, the website. I got one last question for you. Those apprenticeship programs, people want to know more about it. People want to get involved in it. You know, what's the best pathway forward? How do we get more people into your union?
You know, look us up. Call us, find out the information. We're always an open door union, and we want to make sure that we connect with everybody out there.
There you go. Good stuff, Jim. I appreciate you taking time, sharing your thoughts, and good on you for the endorsement. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Jim Slevin, president, as I said, of Utility Workers Union of America, UWUA.net, the website, if you want to check that out. I'm sure there's a lot on there about the apprenticeship programs. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day that updated National Labor Relations Board rules regarding the formation of new unions went into effect. The rules cut down on the time between when workers announce that they want to hold an election to form a union and when that election can actually take place. The rule change was aimed at cutting down delay tactics used by employers to stop unionization. For example, one tactic used by employers was to engage in a long, drawn-out legal battle over which employees could belong to a new proposed bargaining unit. The NLRB's decision helped to curb some of the worst abuses of such tactics. Rich Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, called the new rules, quote, a modest but important step to ensure that workers who want to vote to form a union at their workplace get a fair opportunity to do so. Businesses and their allies in Congress, on the other hand, tried everything they could to fight the decision. The U.S. House of Representatives put forward bills that would make union elections much more difficult and attempted to gut the NLRB's funding. The bills did not make it through the Senate, but later that year, the opponents to the changes were able to get the new rules thrown out, claiming the vote at the NLRB did not follow proper procedures. Finally, in December 2014, the rule changes went into effect. The ability to hold a vote on whether to form a union is a core right for workers who want to improve their working conditions, their wages, and workplace safety. Throughout U.S. labor history, business interests have done everything they can to thwart the will of their workers to join together, and delaying union elections is but one of their tactics. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I'll tell you, I like Jim Slevin. There's a guy who's a leader. The reality is this administration's been doing a lot of things that would help his members, a lot of things that are moving this country in the right direction, a lot of new opportunities for members of the future. That's leadership right there. And good on him. And look, I love the fact that you've got people who are saying, look, it's more than just the beauty contest of Trump and Biden. It's more than just that. It's about their policies. It's more than just, you know, who can deliver the punchline and who gets what zinger. It's about who's going to actually make people's lives better. Who's going to do the work? And I think that's simple. I think Biden is the guy. I've been saying that for a very long time because of the people that he has put into those things. Now, understand, we're in a moment where everybody is regurgitating, you know, the right-wing talking points of, you know, the Bidenomics is bad, you know, the economy sucks, even though, as I started off the show with, things are not bad. Could they be better? Absolutely. Should we be striving for better? Yes, and we're doing that. There are a lot of unions organizing and fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, which we should be encouraging and having a government machinery that is pushing us in that direction. But, you know, I got, you know, into this conversation with my youngest daughter the other night, where I happened to be watching an episode of Good Times. You may remember the old 70s TV show Good Times, where you've got a black family living in the ghetto in Chicago, and the trials and tribulations of what, you know, poverty and things were in the 1970s. And, you know, as we were talking, you know, the reality is the things that keep popping up, nothing changes. You know, the same issues that they were going through back then, we're going through now. It's how you handle them. It's how our media structures them. It's how, perfect example. I was looking at a New York Post article that you just go, who writes these headlines? And why do they write these headlines? And I know why, because it's all about the clickbait. It's all about you making sure that, you know, people get outraged and you know, push the button. But it was about, I almost can't say it. The headline read, "Teacher charged with sexually abusing boy she met at church, long attended by Bill Clinton." And you go, wait a second. Woman sexually abused a child at a church. What did Bill Clinton got to do with this? And this is what our media does. This is what our current clickbait outrage media does to us. It goes, hey, over here, the shiny thing. And changes our attention. Now, I go back to, you know, the 1970s. You know, this episode of Good Times that we're watching, you know, James, the father of the head of the household, he's waiting on a letter from the federal government for a government-approved union apprenticeship program that he's hoping to get. And he's excited that, you know, I might get this. So the letter comes in, oh my gosh, I got the interview and I'm going to get this job and it's going to be great. I'm going to make $2.50 an hour and we're going to be on easy street, because we're going to get this union job, and this union job is going to make all of our lives better. It's going to make all of our problems go away. We're going to make it, because the hard work that I'm doing is going to be rewarded and things are going to be good. That's the frame. Now, ultimately, because, you know, everything has to, you know, we raise things up, you have to tear it down. The letdown is he didn't get the gig because the bad, evil government had an age discrimination clause in it. But for me, it was that union job, better life angle. That was really something that we talked about a lot in the 1970s. And before, my grandparents' generation were a big part of this. But my experience growing up was that idea of union job, better life. Because you saw, not just on TV, their positive depictions of union members, but in life, you saw people get these jobs and their lives got better. Like our neighbor got a job at Ford. They had food at the end of the month. The kids got, you know, secondhand bikes, you know, secondhand better clothes. Eventually they moved up and out, you know, moving on out. You fast forward to the 1980s. What does our media feed us about unions and union workers? They're lazy. They're greedy. They're bullies. You know, got Teamsters with baseball bats. You know, they're thugs. Because the messaging is now, it's bad. Because corporate control is starting. And now we have this push towards unions closed, facilities down, they're all bad. But I'll tell you, I have some hope. Because the younger generation, Gen Z, kind of gets it. They get the idea that collective bargaining can make their lives better. They get the idea that by collective action, they can make society better. And as I've been saying for a very long time, if you want to reunite this country, you got to reunionize it. You got to get back to where my grandparents' generation were at 35% union density instead of 6. When you hear the right wing talk about how powerful the labor movement is, it makes me go, I wish they were right, but not so much. What we're seeing now is a lot of activity around workers saying, look, I want better. And that's exciting stuff. That's good stuff. It's moving us in the right direction. But it's going to come back to the messaging. And what the right wing has figured out is with enough time, with enough repetition, they know they can change hearts and minds, and they have. So for me, there's an opportunity here to start talking about the real effects of people getting union jobs, much like the guy from Good Times. hey, I'm going to get this job and we're going to get good wages. We're going to get good health care benefits. We're going to get retirement security. Things are looking up. Reward to work is returning. And I argue the Biden administration is moving us in that direction with the investments that are happening and ensuring that prevailing wage comes along, ensuring that there is some hey, we want these workers to organize, that there's some language that moves us in that direction. So I got to tell you, I have some great hope that the messaging of the past may be coming around and we're going to make that message great again. I'm right there. But I want to hear your thoughts. Do you remember any of that from the 70s, my older listeners? And do you remember how that changed during the 80s until now when it's all union bashing and worker bashing? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.